Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
I mean, I don't come from Queens, obviously, but I do come from Mobb Deep. I do come from Ice Cube.
Yeah. The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 178, a talk with Sean Slug Daly of Atmosphere. Sean is a proud son of Minneapolis, whose devotion to that city shines through not only in his music, but also in the label he co-founded in large part to help bring shine to his city's scene, Rhymesayers. Atmosphere started when Daly was in high school, but the group really started making waves in the early 2000s, with the release of music that would be collected on the album Lucy Ford, the Atmosphere EPs. The introspective personal songs on Lucy Ford and follow-up projects like God Loves Ugly and Seven's Travels struck a chord with a huge audience, and Atmosphere's constant touring, of a kind much more akin to rock bands than rap acts, helped the group's following grow to a point where they received airplay on MTV2, performed at large festivals, and got a lot of attention from big record labels. Rhymesayers, meanwhile, released well-regarded projects from the likes of Brother Ali, Idea and Abilities, Blueprint, MF Doom, and many others. Atmosphere's latest album, released this past August, is Fishing Blues. We talked to Daly at the Hotel Le Jolie in Brooklyn.
And now, a word from our sponsor. I bet you never thought those were words you were going to hear on The Cypher. This is Josh, the producer, but what you don't know about me is that I'm a certified headphone addict. I have a lot. I'm serious about my headphones. I recently discovered the 99 Classics from Meze Headphones. Their metal and wood design looks amazing, and I'd read that they sounded even better. We reached out to them, and they sent us a few pairs to test out for the next month. So far, I've only had them a couple days, but they've pretty much blown my mind no matter what music I've thrown at them, from Atmosphere to Tech N9ne, from the Geto Boys to Tribe. And with other artists in other genres, including Steely Dan, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and Miles Davis, they've just been incredible. They're also way lighter and fit better than I expected. I'm sure I'll have more to say on future shows, and Sean should be getting his from me shortly. But for now, you can head over to meze.thecyphershow.com. That's meze.thecyphershow.com to find out more information about the company and the headphones. And thanks for supporting us.
To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes. Once you do that, you'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoyed this show, for example, you should listen to our interview with Slug's friend and his partner in the group Felt, Murs, on episode 107. Also consider helping the show by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a show every week takes a lot of time and effort from me and Josh, and we really need your support to continue to maintain this level of output. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just a dollar a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added incentive for our patrons, we try monthly to share some bonus material that sometimes comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. For December, we have some very special unreleased early Ice Cube coming your way. Become a patron by November 30th to get access to the file. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's someone who still isn't sure if he wants a pound or a hug, Sean Slug Daly. Thanks for coming through. It's good to finally sit down with you.
Thanks for having me.
Definitely. So I wanted to start with something I remember from the very first time that I saw you perform with Atmosphere, which was, I guess it must have been like the release of God Loves Ugly in Boston.
Okay.
At the Middle East Down. And I remember you'd gotten a review you really didn't like from the Boston Phoenix. And
I remember that. I read it on stage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that.
Atmosphere. And maybe you don't like us, but of all the stars in the sky, believe we're one of the brightest. My life is as bright as your favorite rap record, and I'm possessed with that insight that enables me to laugh better.
In the July 25th, 2002 issue of the Boston Phoenix, John Caramonica published a review under the title Lady Killer. While we're not certain this is the right review, the time, source, and tone seem to line up. Rather than really talk about the tracks, which the article devotes a couple paragraphs to, it spends most of the time discussing how Slug is apparently trying to attract women. Caramonica closes with the following paragraph. Quote, "It's probable that a good portion of the units Slug moved in the first week of God Loves Ugly's sales were sold to women, girls just like those angling for a few minutes of his time at the Knitting Factory bar. One asks for an autograph. One tells him how much she and her friends love him. One particularly attractive one sidles up next to him, gives him a languorous eye, and turns to order a drink. Slug lets out an almost imperceptible sigh, fishing into his pocket for a drink ticket. Tapping her on the shoulder, he musters his best tortured artist look. Let me get this one, he says. She smiles."
And I guess just using that as a jumping off point, you know, when you sort of first started bubbling a little bit, what was the critical response like? Was that kind of emblematic or?
It was, people didn't want to accept us when we first started to, come out. And it worked in our favor kind of, because it created, it galvanized our fan base to fight that much harder for us. It put us into a underdog position, which is always kind of the best position to be in anything really. But I didn't know what was happening. I didn't, you know, I had nothing to compare it to. All I knew is that, you know, you had all these like uppity journalists and college chumps, you know, going in on us and you know, coming up with big words and names to call us and diss us, and because we didn't sound like what their image of rap was supposed to sound like at the time, you know.
And, you know, I went back and listened to a little bit of Overcast to sort of prepare for this, and it's a very, very different even than the record after it. It's very much more concerned about what hip-hop sounded like in the mid to late 90s, or underground hip-hop, very, like, about rapping.
Yeah. Atmosphere, the mic, let me clutch it. Thoughts take flight, so fit the slug in your pipe and take a puff, kid. Fuck it, I need it like a teapot. Steam hop on the roof, shoot a marble with the verbal slingshot. Take... Well, you know, that's what I grew up listening to, and our first record was definitely us trying to prove to ourselves as well as everybody else that this is what we do, this is what we're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. You know, once they allowed me to get my foot in the door, I mean, Overcast, its biggest impact was locally for me, you know, in the Twin Cities. And once they allowed us to get that foot in the door, that's when I was given, you know, a little bit more freedom to find my own voice instead of sounding like my heroes.
Right. Can you talk about that change a little bit? Because you can hear the sort of more personal stuff a little bit on Overcast. Like, it's kind of bubbling up a little bit. Pain relievers, oral sex and smoker's breath. It stretches for as far as the eye can see. It's reality. Fuck it. It's everything but me. On and on and on. But then by the time the, you know, the Lucy Ford stuff comes, obviously, it's pretty well formed. If I was a smart man, I'd tell you everything that I knew. I'd give it to you every time you need a talking to. But what would that do? Teach you my guidelines so you could be a cheerleader at your game on the sidelines. If I was a driver.
You know, I think I don't really know how to you know, so long ago, and I can't honestly genuinely say where my head was at the time, but when I try to just look at it as somebody who has studied myself, I think it was as simple as, you know, I was insecure about being accepted as an MC. Mm-hmm. And Overcast, it sounds to me like it deals with a lot of that. And, you know, even the songs that were maybe a little bit more personal or had a touch of, you know, my true voice tucked inside of it, even those songs to me sound like somebody who's really trying to prove themselves, like almost, you know, overcompensating for mm-hmm. it. You know, by the time I hit Lucy Ford, I'd already, I guess, resigned to the fact that, you know, I'm not going to be famous doing this. Overcast was a guy who was like, ooh, maybe there's a chance. By Lucy Ford, it was like, nah, there's no chance. So why not just be myself?
That's interesting, because I feel like one of the things on that record, and I'm thinking about Guns and Cigarettes. Ain't gonna land until I'm bigger than Espo, and bigger than ecstasy, and bigger than tech. I wanna be bigger than Jesus, and bigger than wrestling, bigger than the Beatles, and bigger than breast implants. I'm gonna be the biggest thing to hit these little kids. Bigger than guns, bigger than cigarettes. You had this ambition that was sort of bigger than the underground scene at the time, which doesn't seem to go along with, well, I'm never going to be famous.
A song like Guns and Cigarettes was actually like carryover from Overcast, though. That song should have been on Overcast, you know. There was a few songs on Lucy Ford that should have been on Overcast, but we had made too many songs, and, you know, it was already kind of a challenge to incorporate Spawn as much as possible into the record. And
I got the plot from Spawn. From now on, I know the plan.
It's the noise it makes that generates the passion I have. It's the void it breaks that stimulates when mics get grabbed. It takes shape, escapes from these vocal cords I have. Atmosphere, music makers from the rhyme say it's loud. Come now.
Derek Turner, known as Spawn, was a high school friend of Slugs and an original founding member of Atmosphere. The group was first known as Mental Subjects, then Arrhythmic Culture, and then Urban Atmosphere. At first, Spawn was the rapper while Slug DJed, but Spawn convinced Slug to rap as well. Eventually, the pair were introduced to producer Ant, and the Urban was dropped from the group name. Spawn appeared on the group's 1997 debut album, Overcast, but left the group before the second release, 1999's Headshots 7.
So I didn't want to overdo it with way too many solo songs, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There already was too many solo songs on it. So I just saved a few, like Guns and Cigarettes and Party for the Fight to Write.
Some got pencils and some got guns. Some know how to stand and some of them run. We don't get along, but we sing the same song. Party for the Fight to Write. We'll write on. Stay gold, pony boy. Stay true, outspoken. They can recognize the gangster and get them all open with the theories, the stories, the truth, the myths. It's all therapy on top of turntable riffs. This industry's...
Yeah, but a lot of those songs were leftovers from Overcast.
Oh, okay.
Those ones, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of why I called that a collection of EPs, because it was almost like there was an EP's worth of music that was left over from Overcast, and then there was a couple of other. There was the Lucy EP and then the Ford EP. But that was just kind of a tricky way or a joke way to get people to go, what? What is this? A double EP? What does that even mean? You know what I mean?
Right,
like, it's like,
right.
It's an album, you right. know, but we called it a double EP to be funny, kind of.
Right. And obviously the Lucy Ford stuff, the stuff with the Lucy character really resonated with people.
Enough to keep me looking for my Lucy in the sky with gems when I remember how you used to call me baby. Enough to look in my mirror with the test for every tear you shed, regardless of why you wept. Enough to curse any man who can't appreciate the depth of the ocean I swam till I ran out of breath. I love you, don't ever fucking question that. That's why we'll probably never get along. If I was better at finding the right words to say, I wouldn't need to write these motherfucking songs.
When you were writing that stuff, what or who did you think Lucy was, and how has that kind of changed over the years?
Well, when I was writing it, you know, I was drinking a lot and I was smoking a lot and I was not sleeping much. And that really is what Lucy was. It was just kind of my battle with, you know, being this artist who is giving himself fully to that lifestyle. That was the beginning of me, you know, really kind of submitting to the lifestyle of unhealthy art life, you know. And it's crazy because that record got a lot of attention,
right.
Which technically just enabled me to go even further into
right,
that
like, well,
lifestyle.
If this works, yeah. Then yeah.
And so
yeah.
It just kind of, you know, it ate itself. It just became a caricature of itself over time.
Mm-hmm.
And so much so that, you know, my answer to this question itself would change. It would evolve. What is Lucy? Who is Lucy? And whatever I felt like saying at the time is what I would say. You know, I'd make something up. Lucy was my cat or who knows what. But really, Lucy Ford was the devil.
On the right hand, she had a tattoo of a new girl. She claimed it is what God resembled. But on the left, she had a mirrored image of the same female. And this one, she explained, looked like the devil. I remember once watching...
And it was, you know, I wrote about the devil as if the devil was a particular woman or women in my life that were causing all of these troubles and pains for myself. But I mean, at the end of the day, it was just me. You know what I mean? Like, it was just the situations I was putting myself in due to the unhealthy life that I was living. And that was my devil at the time.
And you were kind of also, you know, post the EPs, you're kind of grappling with this idea that, hey, this is what got me the success that I have. I think that shows up on Fuck You, Lucy, right?
Most of this garbage I write that these people seem to like is about you and how I let you infect my life. And if they got to know you, I doubt that they would see it. They wonder what I showed you, how you could leave it.
people like these kinds of songs. What does that mean?
You know, and that was me kind of dealing with the fact that I resented that. You know, I was like, I don't want to be dependent on keeping the devil in my life so that I can have this opportunity to travel the world, you know? And so I had to figure out, you know, to what extent I would continue submitting to that devil.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of what enabled this kind of lifestyle, obviously, was being on the road so much. And you were touring in those early days when I first started seeing you perform, 02, 03, 04, you were touring like a rock band.
Yeah, we were touring more than we were not touring.
Yeah.
You know? But we hadn't quite figured out how to tour. We just thought that our job was to just get in the van and go. You know, there was not a lot of, we don't have the strategies that we have now, you know, whereas now we can actually get the same amount, if not more work done in less time, you know. But touring also was a part of the devil, you know. To me, that tour life was a part of me submitting to the unhealthy lifestyles, you know. And so a lot of that showed up in the writing, all the way up until the Mohawk record. You can't imagine how much fun we're having was when I finally really was able to take a step back and see, you know, how, see all the negative effects that all of this stuff had been having on me as well as my art, you know. On one point, I was always kind of like, you know, oh, it's enabling me to do this art. It's enabling me to travel and see these things. But it's like, that's not true. That wasn't true. I was enabling myself to do this stuff, you know, but I was not ready to admit to myself that I had that in me. So I had to find a scapegoat to blame it on. And so there's no way I could have, you know, allowed myself to believe that I deserved to do this or that I earned this or that I had the talent to do this. So instead I found this other stuff to blame it on. Like it's, oh, it's because I party with the right people or I kick it and I do this and that. And that's how I have been able to live this lifestyle, you know?
Wow. And, you know, just on the actual sort of logistics of touring, I was just curious about, like, you guys were primarily playing, like I said, rock clubs and going into an infrastructure that was set up for bands. How did you figure out how to have rap shows on that circuit? Because you were among the first people to do that in that kind of era of underground rap.
A lot of that actually came from, there was a man named Christian Bernhardt who started booking us. He saw us play. He was, he's a really super tall German guy, but he had lived in Minneapolis for a while and got pretty involved in the scene there. And, he ended up starting a booking agency out west called Cork, and he approached us and he wanted to book us. And his network, he booked rock bands, you know, and so his network was rock clubs, and he started putting us in rock clubs, and it worked. You know, I think a lot of it had to also do with, you know, a lot of these rock clubs back then in the early 2000s, they were still a little scared of rap. They were still, there was this kind of leftover residue from the 90s of, you know, rappers beating up soundmen. You know what I mean? And so a lot of these rock clubs were like, nah, we won't touch that. We're cool. Go talk to the rap promoters. They'll book your show and they'll put you inside of, you know, some club that's not even set up with a right proper PA, you know?
Yeah.
So when Christian convinced some people, no, these guys are really nice guys, and, you know, and when promoters started working with us and seeing how, you know, genuinely happy we were to be there, you know, and we were doing numbers. People were coming out to see it. Everything fell into place, you know. So I think it's like a huge part of that does go to Christian. Christian was huge in getting us into these spots. And then I think just because of who we were and how we treated people, that's what got us to be able to come back over and over, you know.
Yeah. And how would the audiences respond to you? I'm thinking particularly of, you know, one time I saw you perform a bunch was summer you did, or I'm sure maybe it was multiple summers, but summer before you did Warped Tour, and I was on it playing with a band. So I saw you perform it.
What band
a bunch
were you
that
with?
Summer. I was playing with Lords of Brooklyn.
Whoa, yeah, those guys. Oh, right on, man. Yeah. How are they? I haven't seen them dudes since Warped Tour.
Yeah, I've been sort of hear from them every once in a while. I think Caves just opened a restaurant, so shouts to Caves and Donna. Congratulations
dope,
on that.
Dope.
So, but you were playing to, you know, people who were there to see...
NoFX.
No, you know, right, yeah. NoFX and whoever was, you know, headlining that, you know, Good Charlotte or whoever. How were those audiences?
You know, that's another thing where it's like, those audiences were ready to make fun of us until we got going, and then they would go, oh, this isn't what I expected. You know, people, much like how I was just talking about the rock promoters, people, they have this thing in their mind about, you know, what this is and what it's about. And it's sometimes hard for people to like see past that. But once you can show them something and see how human it is, you know, I couldn't tell you the amount of people who have said to me, hey, Atmosphere was like my doorway drug into rap music, and now it's all I listen to. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, back in 2002, somebody gave me God Loves Ugly, and I didn't know rap could be like that. And now I listen to Killer Mike. You know what I mean? Yeah. Or now I listen, you know, and it's like, to me, that's kind of amazing because ultimately, you know, I remember when I would meet people who would say, have you ever heard of this group, De La Soul? And I'm like, of course I've heard of De La Soul, you know? Like, oh, man, I started listening to them, and then I started listening to Public Enemy. And this was like when I was younger, in the early 90s, I would meet these people who they're college kids. You know, I didn't really get to go to college, but I'd be at their parties, and they'd put on a Public Enemy record. And I'd be like, oh, you like this? And like, well, yeah, you know, it's pretty good, right? And then years later, they're listening to all kinds of rap, you know? And I felt like, whoa, I got to take part in some sort of like, you know, some sort of something similar to what my heroes got to take part in, just opening the doorway and expanding this music to show people how universal it really is, you know, to show people like, you know, the things that we talk about and the things that we deal with are, it's not as exclusive as sometimes even we try to make you feel. Yeah. Like, you know, it's open for everybody.
One of the ways you show that, I think, is by dropping in little quotes from other rap songs, be it, you know, EPMD.
The importance of a year, yeah, we're back to work. I took time off. All the rappers got jerked due to the fact they whacking their track. Have to go back and stack because they lack.
The employees of the year, now we back to work. We took time off. A couple feelings got hurt due to the fact that we never stand still. The ones they can't catch, the ones they can't kill.
Or like I mentioned before this interview started, Ice Cube.
You got any last words?
Yeah. Yeah, I got some last words. Fuck all y'all.
Yeah, I got some last words. Fuck all of y'all. Stop.
Mobb Deep.
Yeah. To all the killers and the $100 billers. Yo, the phone, okay. Your eyes for real, niggas who ain't got no feelings.
To all my killers and my $100 billers. To emo kids that got too many feelings.
He held the
that you, you know, they're just sort of there and gone.
Sure.
Right?
Yep.
Why do that?
I mean, it's just part of representing where you come from, you know? I mean, I don't come from Queens, obviously, but I do come from Mobb Deep. I do come from Ice Cube. You know, this music, it's part of my DNA. And so it's the same as representing my city. It's this, you know, it's like it's like rule number three in rap is that you represent what you are, what you stand for, you know? And so part of that was just to kind of, and I'm not like the only guy that has done that, you know,
but
I think just part of a, it's just to show people who we are, you know, what we came out of.
Yeah.
It's a tradition.
I want to dig in just to Ice Cube for a second, just because, you know, you quote him a lot.
Once upon a time in the projects, yo, I damn near had to wreck a hoe. I knocked on the door. It's Ice Cube come to pay a little visit to you.
Once upon a time in Minneapolis, yo, I damn near had to steal the show. I stepped on the stage. Who is it? My name's Slug. I've come to kill a couple minutes. And what's up with the...
And you even sort of put your own spin on jacking for beats.
Oh,
and
yeah.
All that.
Yeah.
Which was great.
That was gross.
Give me that beat, fool. It's a full-time jack move. Chili Chill, yo, homie, make the track move. And I'm back anytime, Dick and Hank. That's the name of the suckers out of you.
That freak, fool, another jack move. Sit still. Mr. Dibs, yo, homie, how it tits feel. Real jack any city, town, or village. Dig a hole just to see if I can fill it. I stay away from you rappers. Flip a dime and wipe her off with some napkins.
Well, first off, yeah, get into that. What was that? That seems like you were having fun with it.
Oh, I was having fun, and that definitely came from that era of when I was probably having too much fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm man, fortunately, I was able to document that era a little too well, and it's there for all of my sons to grow up in here and ask me questions about someday.
Right.
But yeah, Ice Cube was a huge influence of mine, you know, top five, dead or alive. I put him in the top five.
Yeah. You know, definitely wanted to talk for a second about some of the music you released that didn't make it to albums. You had a ton of stuff, EPs, and especially like the Sad Clown Bad Dub stuff. There are songs on there that are still some of your best love songs. I know Body Pillow, you, at least the last few times I saw you, were still performed sometimes.
She still wonders why I'm so insecure. She giggles because I sleep with the body pillow. Intentions are never nothing short of pure. It's a place to pay eyes for me. Try to live a little as attractive as that nap can ever could have been. My eye would unfold it, hold it to the wind.
Why release those that way and never properly on an album?
Oh, because the record label couldn't keep up with us,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it would be silly for me to expect them to, you know.
Even though you are the label.
Well, yeah, but I, you know, I don't like to, I'm not the label. I'm a part of the label, mm-hmm. you know. And the thing about being an artist on an artist co-op label like this is, if, you know, Atmosphere already gets the majority of the attention when you compare us to some of the other groups on the label. We're the flagship artist.
Right.
And so if it, you know, if I start really pushing harder to take all the resources and put it all on Atmosphere, I mean, it is just, it becomes a conflict of interest, and that's not how you run a business, mm-hmm. you know? So for me, I saw the benefit to putting out music for free, putting out extra music, you know, even just on the side, you know, some of those Sad Clowns, we did those without the label even realizing we were doing them at first, you know?
Yeah.
Atmosphere has released 13 projects in their Sad Clown Bad Dub series, which includes live albums, EPs, compilations, mixes, unreleased material, and DVDs. Sad Clown Bad Dub 2, which Slug discusses in just a minute, was released in September 2000 and was originally limited to 500 copies to be sold on tour.
You know, it was pre-internet, or it wasn't pre-internet, but it was before it was super easy for Sadiq to go online and see that me and Anthony were putting songs out on the side,
right.
you know?
Sadiq is Rhymesayers Entertainment co-founder Brent Sayers, who Sean talked to for Forbes at the time of Rhymesayers' 20th anniversary in November 2015. We'll link to the article in our show notes.
And sometimes you capture something on the demo that you can't recapture when you go and try to remake it in the studio. Mm-hmm. And you know, I learned that early on. Me and Ant both, we both knew that. So sometimes when a demo is so right, then you're just like, well, I don't even want to try to remake this then. You know, this one is what it is.
Yeah.
You know, when you make a demo and you can hear the room for growth, you're like, oh, there's a great idea here. That's the one that you build on and you put on the record. But when you nail something in one take and, you know, you started it today and it's the end of the night and it's done and you're like, man, yeah. That's just what it is. It's got to go out like that.
And Body Pillow is a song like that, too?
Oh, yeah. Everything on that Sad Clown 2.
Yeah.
Sad Clown 2. The first Sad Clown was a record that I actually sat at home and made on Christmas because all of my family was doing stuff without me. And I was like, you know what? This is great. I'm going to sit home all day by myself and make a record. I borrowed Ant's 4-track. I brought it home, and I wrote songs and recorded them myself.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it was so fun that we decided, oh, let's do another one with some of these songs that we have, you know, and that's where Body Pillow came out of that session. You know, the only song on the Sad Clown 2 that was intentionally made for Sad Clown 2 was the song Sad Clown, because mm-hmm. that's when I was like, well, we need like an intro to this piece, you know, and so we made that specifically for that.
Hey, Daddy, tell me why the clown is crying. Well, son, he's got the task of cheering up the ill and dying. On top of that, everybody thinks he's insane. Can't fathom why he'd want to ease their pain. Walking through this.
Everything else on there was all demos that we were like, this isn't going to get any better.
Right.
You know, even if we go into a studio and spend $50 an hour and have an engineer and master it and blah, 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 it's not going to get any better than what it is right here.
Yeah. And I wanted to talk about Seven's Travels for a second, because I feel like that was the record that kind of bumped Atmosphere up a bit in terms of popularity. You guys had a video, I think, for Try to Find a Balance.
Yep.
You had a video for that that actually, you know, got airplay on MTV. That was the album you were promoting when you were on Warped. And you have that line on, I think, on Balance, Now All My Friends Are Famous.
Now all my friends are famous. See the one thing or another. Y'all don't know what my name is.
probably know both of our brothers. One is a hard
one. Oh, yeah.
Which I don't know where that came from, obviously, but it seems to be kind of a reflection of like, okay, I'm moving up a little bit here. I'm sort of in different circles.
Sure. You know, but also I think that song was referencing not just moving up into those circles, but also it's regretful. It's almost like apologetic that you're moving into those circles, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was always something I struggled with. I was older than the majority of my peers. And to this day, I still kind of am like, but in the late 90s, early 2000s, all the people I was coming up with, I was 4 to 5 years older than all of them. And so I always kind of felt like I couldn't just run towards the party open armed and just embrace it. Part of me had to also responsibly resent the party at the same time. Like, I'm here at the party, but I really should be doing something else with my time right now. You know, and that's kind of, and that was kind of my steez, you know, genuinely, not even intentionally, but just that was where my head was at for many of those years. Because I knew better, but I was still there. So it's like, I was at your party and I was partying and I was staying up too late, but I'm not going to do any of your cocaine. You know, that was kind of where I would draw the line. But that's what made me the prude at the party, you know? But then I was still there. I was still trying to make out with everybody, and I was still wasted and thrown up in the corner, you know?
It reminds me of something that I'd completely forgotten about. But during your shows from that period, you were often stopped to give a monologue against cocaine specifically.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Boycott cocaine, you stupid fucking idiots. Listen, man. You want to get high? That's cool. Get high. I'm not going to judge you. But don't get high on cocaine. Do you realize what it takes for that drug to get up your little self-entitled nostril? Do you know what it goes through before it gets up your fucking nose? Go find out where cocaine comes from. Find out about the child slavery that exists in South America just to ensure that you get to sniff that white shit.
Well, I mean, especially at the time, because that was when you know, as a kid, I saw a lot of cocaine around just because of the adults that were around me. They were doing it in the 80s. It was huge, you know. And then I saw a lot of crack. And that was, you know, mid to late 80s. And now I saw those same adults just kind of withering away. And then in the 90s, it went away. The cocaine just disappeared. And I loved that. I was glad because I didn't want it to beat up my friends as we were all entering adulthood, you know, and you know, I credit hip hop in a big way for really imprinting a lot of us.
Even if you were doing crack, you had to have an anti-crack song.
Running, selling, smelling, sniffing, riffing, and brothers trying to get swift in, selling their own love of home, while some shrivel a bone like comatose walking around. Please don't confuse this with the sound.
Y'all take a look at this rock. She was getting some heavy. Hurry up quick, somebody give me a light. His light said hold it, he was pulling too fast. But Jane was amused by the smoke of the glass. She was tickled to death at the faces they made. Put fire to the glass, don't you think it will break? In a flick of a flash, the torch was lit. She put it to her mouth and she took a hit. Smoke rushed from her lungs and up to her brain. This was the beginning of the end of Jane.
Kind of. Yeah. You know, it, but I think it saved a lot of us from ever crossing that line, mm-hmm. you know? And so when I saw coke making a comeback, you know, around 2000, 2001, I started seeing it show up around at the parties again. It pissed me off. It's my enemy.
Yeah.
My enemy was cocaine. And to this day, you know, also I read a book, The Autobiography of Cocaine, which I still suggest people read. It's a pretty intense book, and it really breaks down a lot of, you know, a lot of this stuff now is kind of common knowledge. We know where it came from. We know how it got here. We know why it got here. But this book really broke down. It got more in depth with a lot of the people who really get hurt by this. You know, I mean, it's basically child slave labor that it starts there with the plant and makes its way to America and it fucks up everybody it touches along the way. Not just the people doing it, but everybody involved with getting it here and everybody involved with selling it here and what have you. It's the devil.
What kind of responses would you get from people when you would stop a show to basically say that in the middle of like this giant party?
I mean, you know, people will cheer and agree with you because you're the guy on the stage. But then later that night, they're going to go home and they're going to sniff blow with their friends. You know what I mean? It's just, it's an interesting thing. You know, the young liberal is a really awkward being, you know what I mean? Cause it's like the young liberal is doesn't want to wear, you know, sweatshop made tennis shoes and doesn't want to eat, you know, GMO based foods or doesn't want to eat meat, but in the same breath, like, it's like, well, but that cell phone in your pocket came from, where did that come from? You know, and that cocaine that you're doing, where did that come from? You know? And so it's like, really, it really is about, trying to show people, you know, we all are dirty. We're all dirty somehow. And so if you're gonna, you know, take stances, take them, but also kind of see how there's a word for that, you know, I like to say poke holes, just poke holes in yourself, poke holes in the things you're doing, you know, make sure that you're taking a good hard look at yourself and seeing where your contradictions are and your own inner conflictions.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to talk for a minute about your writing. Now, people have, you know, since the beginning of rap or the beginning of writing, have written about, you know, heartbreak and, you know, that kind of stuff. But you, at least in sort of the popular imagination, a lot of your rapping, you became known for, like, oh, he's the guy who writes the emotional songs about girls or whatever. Which, you know, there was truth to that, but it also wasn't near the whole story. Can you talk about both writing like that, writing sort of in that lane, and then people perceiving you like, oh, that's all you do?
Sure. Well, in the 90s, when I started, late 90s, when I started, you know, just when I found my voice and started focusing on it, what I realized was that the voice I felt most confident in was the one that told the truth. And so I started to apply that to all of my concepts, all of my topics, like, for lack of a better bumper sticker, just keeping it as real as possible. Which, you know, meant being okay with saying embarrassing things about myself, which was kind of some new ground for hip hop. Mm-hmm. You know, in hip hop, you never threw yourself under the bus. I mean, some did, but when they did, it was obvious comedy.
Right. This is the funny song where I'm doing that.
Slick Rick would do it, but when he did, it was for making a point, you know, and I loved that. Like, that's a big part of what I started to do did come from Slick Rick, actually, especially like a song, The Moment I Feared by Slick Rick, where at the end of the song, he actually ends up in jail getting raped by somebody.
Now I'm in jail doing life, and I'm scared some kids snuff me cold and grease me when no one did. This was the moment I feared. Turn around, nigga. This was the moment I feared.
That was unheard of for rap. You know, he did that and not many rappers would go there, but everybody loved that song. And so I'm like, well, I like the idea of showing the resolution, even when it didn't work out in the favor of myself, you know? So I started writing like that. And, you know, when I was a kid, I remember when LL Cool J put out Walking with a Panther and there was like 6 girl songs on that record.
Yo, let me tell you about a girl named Peg. Straight up and down, sweetheart. Where I never do you wrong. You're the type of guy that can't control your girl. Did you ever notice every time you fall in love and it seems like you finally met the perfect match? Taking a break, admiring the girls with the bamboo earrings, baby hair, and body. I want you to be my girl.
So and I'm like, what the fuck, man? Like, you're allowed to. You just put 6 on this record. It pissed me off. So for me to years later be that guy that would put 6 of them on my record, it really blew me away that I allowed myself to reach that point. But really what it was the honesty thing. I just wanted to make music that was honest and that spoke to myself in a way that I could feel, that I could relate. In an interview once in 98 with Dave Thompson, I think that was his name, I coined a phrase. He asked me about my music and I was like, well, I make cynical, minimalistic emo rap, and it stuck. And years later, people started calling us emo rap. And they would say it in this way of trying to put us down without realizing I actually made the phrase up. Like, I invented the term. I'm not really. We had emo rock. I just stole it from that to be funny.
Yeah.
But I was cool with it because at the end of the day, it was like, well, it's a, you know, the definition of that or the way that I saw that, it was like, well, yeah, Ghostface makes emo rap and Tupac made emo rap. So I'm totally cool with being called emo rap, even in a non-ironic joke way, because I felt like it did speak to what I was trying to get across. Now, the fact that people use that and tried to say, well, that's all he does is he makes songs for girls. I mean, a lot of that was just people kind of dealing with, I think, especially other, like, let's say some of my contemporaries. A lot of attention was paid to how quickly we were moving up the ladder. And people didn't want to look too deep into why. So they quickly just wrote it off as,
oh, they have girls at their shows.
They have girls at their shows. They make songs for chicks. It's all goth white chicks at their shows, you know? And it was just an easy way to not have to actually question why you don't have girls at your shows or why you don't have this audience, you know? And so I saw through it. Like I said, you know, like I referenced before, I was a little bit older than a lot of these guys, you know? And so I had an understanding of why, you know, why people felt the need to do that. And it didn't really bother me so much. You know, I had pushback at very first because I, you know, obviously I'm like, why are you shitting on me? But once I realized why, then I was like, oh yeah, go for it. You know what I mean? Because ultimately, at the end of the day, it's due to successes that I'm seeing. So let me own it and be proud of it. You know?
And, you know, part of that, I think it, you saw sort of very early on where that could lead. You have that line on It Goes, my fans know me better than my friends do.
I'll bet my fans know me better than my friends do because my friends don't pay that much attention. The fans memorize every single sentence, which makes them far too smart to ever start a friendship. I need to start writing pieces about other people's problems because the strangers are starting to get worried.
Which I thought was kind of emblematic of the open songs you were writing. I don't know if that was true in 1997 or became true, you know, 5 years later or whatever, if you kind of wrote that into existence or something.
Like, that's a good question. I used to have this problem where I felt like I was writing things into existence to the point where I hit a phase where I was very careful about what I wrote about, you know, because, you know, I had songs where I died in car crashes.
On the way to arrest, her drunk ass turns to look at me and she says, you're so beautiful from the hair to the soul. Can't believe that I've never met you before. Feels like I've been waiting for you my whole life. She missed the red light, we hit a pickup truck and we both died.
These are songs where, you know, all these things happen. And then somewhere around Seven's Travels, I realized, whoa, I gotta chill out because I don't, you know, I don't want to accidentally, I was becoming the caricature. It's weird because, you know, when I started, I was writing about the things that I was doing. And then as I started to expand on some of those ideas, you know, I would fictionalize it. It would still be rooted in truth, but I would fictionalize it, it for the sake of the narrative. Mm-hmm. And then I was starting to see some of these things come true. And that's when I was like, I gotta really do a 180. And I did. That was
the album you did all the narratives.
That was the Mohawk record was the beginning. The You Can't Imagine was the beginning of that 180, because that's where I was like, okay, I got to take all of these concepts that I've been working with for the last couple of albums and figure out how to point all the arrows inward and dead all of them. And so one by one, I went through all of the, you know, there's a song in there called Little Man, which was basically me taking all of the, you know, people used to say, oh, you're the introspective rapper. So I'm like, this is the most introspective as it can get.
The only women that love you are fans and family. Mom has no choice, but fans leave you randomly. No heavy rotation in any location. You're not ready to face that you have no steady vocation.
It's just laid out. There's a song, Angel Face, which is the, to me, it was the one where I deaded the fucking song about traveling for women.
And I'm a lost soul trying to find a road that's paved. Keep faith in my suitcase, pack my beliefs. Angels exist, I've even seen some sleep. I love this country. And she loved me more than I could imagine. So I waited till she slept and I stepped in the trap.
You know what I mean? It was like, so I went through and I wrote all these songs out, you know. Get Fly was the, like, here's my political song that basically is just like, after this, if I choose to never write another political song, I don't have to because this is the one.
I used to be mad at the government, redirected some of my anger towards the mothership.
trying to guess which shell live in hell sleeps under when the grand scheme plan keeps all these people wondering why we still.
The whole record is that, you know, I don't know if anybody ever even caught on to what that record was, but that record was me just one at a time taking every single part of my identity and just making it as basic and simplified as possible, writing it out in a very like almost linear way so that I could move on to something else. And then that's what I did with the Lemons record after that, was I completely moved on and went straight narratives that were not about me for the most part. You know, there's one song on the Lemons record called Me, which was kind of like, oh, I forgot to put this one on the Mohawk record. And that's the one where I kind of just talk about my childhood and how I got from where I was to where I'm at, you know?
Yeah, the child in the mirror was homely, so we learned early on how to switch into low key. Little person, observant and accurate, grew the skills to argue and the passion to back it with. Kick over the blocks just to rebuild them, cause mom and pop used to pop, sound familiar. Daddy had to leave, but mama kept hurting, so we stepped up to help be an anchor and a burden.
And you've called, you can't imagine how much fun we're having, the Mohawk record a couple of times, which obviously, is it just because it has a long title and
yes,
that comes to mind? Jeez. There's no significance to the haircut. It wasn't like...
Oh, well, the haircut was because I lost my hair. All my hair fell out due to a condition called alopecia that happened because of a tooth infection. And so when my hair started to kind of grow back, it was still a little patchy, but I realized, oh, I can at least grow a Mohawk. So I grew a Mohawk first until it eventually all came back.
Wow, I didn't realize that was behind it. So... you obviously have the sort of not being afraid of self-depreciation, like you talked about in your rap.
Atmosphere finally made a good record. Yeah, right. That shit almost sounds convincing.
Fucking slut. Oh my god, he is so fucking ugly.
There's a lot of humor there. It seems to kind of go hand in hand with it a lot of times.
I think it does go hand in hand. And I think that, you know, comedians have really... enabled us to work with self-depreciation in a way that is progressive. It's not just this guy feeling sorry for himself, but if I can make you laugh while poking at myself, then there's you know, something productive coming out of it, you know? So it's not just a pity party. But also, you know, when I was a kid, man, I was a class clown. I was adamant about getting the attention of everybody in the room. And the best way to do that was to crack a joke. And the most non-offensive way to crack a joke is to crack a joke about yourself, you know?
Yeah. And so, you know, you talked about the emo rap thing, and about 10, 11 years into your career, this whole sort of sound and approach hits the mainstream, I think, first with Kanye West and 808s and Heartbreak.
Oh, how could you be so heartless? How could you be so Dr. Evil? You're bringing out a side of me that I don't know.
And then Cudi, you're nodding as if you know what I'm going to get at.
Tell me what you know about dreaming, dreaming. You don't really know about nothing, nothing. Tell me what you know about them night terrors every night. 5 a.m. cold sweats waking up to the sky. Tell me what you know about...
Some of the... approaches that you were doing a decade before all of a sudden are mainstream.
Sure.
And I guess, you know, how do you feel about that? Do you think you had a part in it? Or, I mean, where do you see yourself kind of in that scope? And how do you feel about it?
I do believe I had a part in helping, just helping it along. You know, I think there were rappers even before me who made me feel safe going there. You know, like I mentioned Slick Rick, but also I would say, you know, I would even say Cool Keith.
I'm sick, traveling hard, ill, off, another lunatic, smacking germs, eating bugs, biting mouse. Roaches wonder while I'm traveling, on to Bellevue because I'm sick, traveling hard at the speed of thought.
I would say De La Soul.
I'm a hurt man, I love to make advances. I guess a father must have got the same feeling. I mean, actually finding his own daughter nearly appealing. At the time, no one knew, but it was a shame that me became a victim of the touchy-touchy game.
You know, some of these artists felt okay with being honest about certain things. Even if they weren't keeping it real, they were still giving you this honest concept to think about and deal with. And I feel like I just played a part in that. I'm just another guy who helped that. Now, you know, I do think that you can draw direct lines from Slick Rick to me to Macklemore and Drake, or to like you mentioned Cudi, and I actually think Cudi is a little bit apart from it, because I feel like what Cudi does is actually, it's bigger than what Drake does, or it's bigger than what the way Cudi speaks, man, I think there's something about Cudi that can save lives. You know what I'm saying? Like, I've seen the effect he's had on certain people. I don't see that with Drake per se. Drake makes hot music and people love it and it sounds great. And he's, you know, he is a great vehicle for that music. But whereas Cudi, to me, is like, there's something special about Cudi the same way there was something special about Cobain, in my opinion, you know? And I don't know that I could draw a line from me to Cudi so much, because I don't know. You know, I know I've had plenty of fans who have been like, hey, I listen to your music and it speaks to me and it's helped me and it's gotten me through stuff, you know, but I've always been careful to really like acknowledge like, well, I didn't help you get through that. You got through that. And my music was playing in the background while you were working on that. And I appreciate that, you know, whereas I do see Cudi as being like symbolic of somebody who I just think, man, like, It's that thing again, where that the kid who really just doesn't know and doesn't understand why they feel the way they feel, I think certain artists can help them figure that kind of stuff out, you know? And so to me, it's a little different, but I do think, you know, Kanye, good example. And I don't necessarily, I would never say, yo, Kanye heard Atmosphere. And
sure,
that's
I didn't think you were
But I do think that Atmosphere just kind of helped a little bit turn the tides so that kind of stuff was that much more acceptable, you know? Yeah. And Kanye took it and made it even bigger. You know, I would say Kanye really, you could probably draw a line from Kanye to Cudi, and you could draw a line from Kanye to Drake, you know, that are even stronger than the lines that you could draw from me to anybody. Because I think Kanye did it in a way that made it okay for the cool guy to admit his faults. Whereas I was never the cool guy, you know, I was already faulty and I'm admitting my faultiness, you know what I mean? And so that was just nature taking its course. But Kanye came along and he was like, he was still the cool guy, but he also had flaws. And I feel like that's huge.
Yeah.
I never really framed it like that or thought about it like that before. So thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, of course. I want to talk about Mikey for a second. Mm-hmm.
Mikey here is Michael Idea Larson, who passed away in October of 2010. He released several albums on Rhymesayers, both solo and in the duo Idea and Abilities. He was also an incredibly talented freestyler and won tons of titles, and a trip to YouTube would be well worth your time. Among those freestyles on YouTube, you can find what Idea does when Slug rips on his mustache, like he did on Sway and Tech's Wake Up Show back in 2001.
Yeah, I give you a razor so you can shave that mustache. I give you everything you need to get where the hell you gotta go. Go ahead and kick your little flow,
hey,
yo.
I know that the fact is my mustache is dirty, but I'm 20. But with this, chicks think that I'm 30. So they're like, man, I like you. You wanna just dance, but MCs don't know they never could advance. I'm like an avalanche, the battle stands are shaking.
You look like a werewolf.
Yo.
But it's all good, we're taking care of everything, we gotta take care of making sure they feel what we got to give them, that feeling and make them all touch the ceiling.
That feeling inside of their mind, that feeling that makes them want to go after the radio show and write them some rhymes. Tight, I'm divine, shining MCs don't know how I'll be rhyming, breaking hymen. I'm the one who always coming through and running crews out of their own city. They flow, can't get with me. Who is on the microphone? They just be kicking at 50 news. I be ripping crews because my style is not pitiful.
So tell them you heard them kids' ideas.
To hear more about Idea, check the Cypher episode 107 with MERS and episode 110 with Blueprint.
We've had a bunch of people on the show who have known him, who knew him, and who talked about him. What's your first memory of Mikey?
When I first met Mikey, he wasn't rapping. He was a breakdancer. He was part of a group called the Battle Cats. They're from mostly St. Paul, but also, you know, slowly but surely, due to Headshots, which was part of the family of rappers I was in. The Battle Cats were starting to show up in Minneapolis.
Put your hands up, put your hands up, put your hands. I'm Slug Infinite, he's no idea.
Please refrain from screaming.
The Battle Cats were formed in 1993 by Jason Knorr and Damian Daylight Day. One of Minnesota's most influential B-boys, Stepchild, referred to the crew in an interview as having, quote, complete B-boys and B-girls, meaning they had standardized power and groundwork, always explored and experimented, then integrated with abstract styles as well as on-point power tricks and battle focus. The Battle Cats formed a close alliance with Rhymesayers and battled in cities all over the Midwest. Idea's mother recalls him joining the crew when he was around 13 or 14, which would have been within the first year or two of its existence.
When I first met Mikey, he was like one of the first dudes that I was like, oh, wow, you're really good at spinning on your head. You know, on TV or at break battles, you would see it, but he was the first person that I got to know that could, like, he could spin on his head forever, you know? That's why he had such a thick, muscular neck, I swear. When you see pictures of him rapping sometimes, look at his neck, because the muscles are just popping out of his neck and it looks super intense. And it's not because of how intense he is at rapping. Mm-hmm. It's because his neck was just muscle, because he used to use it to support, you know, 150 pounds of body when he was spinning on his head.
Yeah.
Sorry about the vacuum.
Oh, that's fine. Danger of being in a hotel is fine.
But he was a breakdancer at first. So when I found out he was rapping, I was like, oh, yeah, whatever. But that's kind of how I felt about all new rappers. I didn't want no more rappers in my city. All of my friends were rappers, and that was enough. Right. So when he crossed the line from breaking into rapping, initially I was just kind of like, yeah. But he actually was really good at it. And so I embraced it immediately, you know. Me and his mother became friends, and I think she saw in me somebody that she could trust to look after Mikey if she couldn't be around, you know. And all of that created the relationship that that we had. Me and Mikey's relationship was, I mean, to put it bluntly, it was very complex, because we were peers as rappers, but as people, I was pretty much 10 years older than him. And the pressure that his mom had put on me to take care of him put me into this position of being like an older sibling, which allowed for resentment to come into play, you know, because if I'm the guy going, dude, go to bed, take your butt back to your hotel room and go to bed. You shouldn't be here right now at this party. You know, it's like, oh man, you know, why you know, and then at other times I'm like, no, I'm going to take you to this party because you should be at this party, because we're going to go grab the mic or who knows what, you know? And so it's like, and those complexities stayed with us until the end. You know, and it's funny too, because depending on when you entered Mikey's life, you know, I've met people who have been like, yeah, Mikey made me think he didn't even like you. You know, and I'm like, well, you entered Mikey's life, you know, at a stage where, yeah, he probably did have complaints about me, because I was very real with Mikey. You know what I mean? Like I never pampered him. I always was very, very upfront with him about everything. And many times that meant me telling him things that he didn't really want to hear. You know what I mean? And, yeah. You know, and due to that kind of honest relationship and that kind of love, but also resentment that we had going on. And also, you know, there's dependency there too, in a way, because when he was, you know, 16, 17, and I was taking him on tour, I had to have a piece of paper signed by his mom giving me permission to take him across state lines. You know what I'm saying? And so yeah. It's like, I knew I was responsible for this dude. And I was a parent. I was also a young parent at the time anyway. And so right. I probably flexed a ton of parentalness towards him that he didn't want to have, you know. He didn't need it.
The whole point of being on tour, right?
Yes, exactly.
Get to do what you want.
And so, you know, it was very complex. And that was just the beginnings of it. And then when you start working in business of the label or business of the touring machine or what have you, you know. And he thought he was a much better rapper than me too. So you also had to work in the fact that, you know, at some point he's like, why is Atmosphere getting all of this? Why not Idea and Abilities? How come we're not getting as much shine as Atmosphere? You know, all of that stuff comes into play, you know? Sure. But at the core of it, we were just two dudes that really loved rap. And so the minute that the two of us got away from everybody else and just sit in a car and listen to like an old Jungle Brothers tape or something like that, that's when, you know, we would remind each other of what our closeness was and where it stemmed from.
Where were you when you found out he passed?
I was outside of San Bernardino, California. I had a show at it's called the Smokeout. It's like a big weed fest show that Cypress Hill throws. We were playing the Smokeout, and that was likely a Saturday.
Sloak's memory is correct here. The 2010 Smokeout Festival took place on Saturday, October 16th, and this is actual audio from the show.
And he had passed that day, I don't remember what time he actually had passed away, because he died in his sleep. But the next morning, or that night, I started getting calls because nobody had seen him for the majority of that day. And finally, his mom went over to his apartment to go and check on him. And then she found him. And that night, I was sleeping in a hotel room in San Bernardino. And I started getting phone calls from a phone number I didn't recognize. So I ignored it. I didn't answer it. And then the next morning, got a call from Sadiq, who basically was like, yo, and he told me what had happened. And so I had to drive from San Bernardino to Los Angeles to LAX. And it was, I was with the whole band at the time. We were still touring with the band. And I had given the news to everybody in the band. And it was a, you know, everybody knew him, everybody that I work with. And so everybody loved him, but I think everybody kind of just really stayed out of my way for pretty much the rest of that day and maybe even a week. I was on crutches because I had torn my meniscus about a week prior, but still had to go play this show. I couldn't get out of the show. And so I was, you know, I shouldn't have even been in California. I should have been at home, you know. But yeah. I remember I called iSelf Divine, Shaka. I called Shaka on the phone during the drive just to give him the news, and he had already heard. And I ended up spending most of that drive on the phone with him, kind of just talking about memories and ideas and thoughts of Mikey.
And his freestyling, I think particularly, which was the thing that kind of made him jump out of the crowd, was unbelievable, I guess, as someone who saw it up close. What can you describe about his freestyling, about the way he thought about it, about how he did it?
You know, I don't want to like overstate it, and I'll just keep it as like simplified as possible. He remembered every word that rhymed with every word. He never would forget a word, you know? So it's like it was someday when he realized that gastral infections rhymes with astral projections, it would store in his head and stay there until he finally said it in a rhyme, you know? And that ability I thought was pretty amazing. And a lot of that I think came from, he was sober, you know, he was sober and vegetarian and super healthy. And I think he was really big on, you know, exercising his mind and using his mind. Later in life, when he started, drinking and smoking cigarettes and partying and hanging out more, he, I don't think was as technically, his freestyles weren't as technical as they were during the sober days, but they, at that point, he had already done so much freestyling that his mind was just expanded to being able to just go. And so it was a different kind of freestyling that he had reached, where it was kind of like he will make up a song, an improv, a whole 3-minute song with a concept and a hook and everything.
I would never give you anything but a kiss to make you feel okay. And as I feel the gray skies break apart, I take your heart and hold it to the sky and try to make it art. Let's make it start, let's make it stop, let's do all the same. Falling in between the walls you claim, it's the tallest brain.
So it was a different kind, you know, whereas the earlier stuff, it was more battle mode or let me impress you with my skills and what I can make rhyme.
Yeah.
Look at your little generic wristwatch, kids get off, I'll flip you like sausage. MCs just get tossed quick, I'm glad you realize the battle's over and you lost it.
Later in life, when he became an adult who liked to drink like the rest of us, it was more like he had expanded his mind and opened his mind to like unlimited possibilities. And he would do whole shows. Like he had a project in Minneapolis that would play shows, and it was him, two other rappers, and they would freestyle a whole show.
Across the sidewalk, caught a rose. My thoughts arose to me, and I sat inside of the back row. Eyes closed, I can see the sky divided inside my skull. And I know that snow is gonna eventually rain. It's bending my brain, sending me to my destiny, and the rest is insane.
I wanted to ask you about Felt, because that's some of my favorite stuff personally. You know, obviously Felt as a duo project is like a little bit more lighthearted than some of the atmosphere stuff.
Get off the mic, go straighten out your
life for. One of these MCs puts it on your wife.
Your girlfriend got her panties off. Once again, wanting all that nasty shit that I done to a friend. So once again, it's all motherfucker and you won't do shit. You a bitch, so fuck you.
Why is that? Is it just sort of the mode you and Murs get in when you're working together?
Or? Well, I can't count on Murs to talk about anything serious. he can't keep up with me when it comes to, no, I'm just kidding. No, it's just because I think when the two of us get together, we both use felt as an opportunity to do things that we both don't really want to do on our records. You know what I mean? Like, Merce records are pretty serious too.
Yeah.
Atmosphere records are pretty serious. And so when we get together, it's like, well, why not show other parts of our personality, you know, that we don't necessarily always get to show on our own solo records.
And the way you took that orange oil rag and wiped it clean is guaranteed to get repeated in my dreams. You make me wild, feels like puppy love. Got so lost in your smile when you asked me what the mileage was and if I ever learned how to change my own oil. Promise that this customer is gonna remain so loyal.
Dirty girl, dirty, dirty, you're such a dirty girl.
Atmosphere music takes itself very serious. It's very self-aware. It's self-aware music, which is unfortunate at times. You know,
How do you mean?
Well, because when art is self-aware, it becomes very insular. You know, it becomes, you know, here's the thing. You know, people put Jay-Z as, you know, one of the greatest of all time or whatever. And I've always liked Jay-Z, but I've never been a Jay-Z stan. I've never, you know, he's never been one of my favorites. You know, I hear songs here and there that, like, he can rhyme, he can rap his ass off, he's a great rapper. But his music was always too insular for me. It was always too self-aware. And so that sucks for me because I realize how self-aware atmosphere music is as well. And but that's the thing that I try to use to try to remind me to be more inclusive with my music. You know what I mean? And that's not to say I want to write a song that the whole world can sing. I still want to write songs that are from my soul and basically for me. But I want to write them in a way that doesn't make anybody else feel like they're being shut out of the box. You know right. what I'm saying? So weird that I just used Jay-Z like that to just describe no, that,
it,
whatever.
It makes sense. I think one of the things that I do like about him, I think, is that sense of insularity, that sense that, like, everything he rhymes is part of, like, the same story.
Sure.
And so if you know the whole story, this little bit, this little addition makes sense.
Sure, yeah,
but
yeah.
if you don't, maybe it sounds a little weird.
And so with felt, it's like, oh, man, we could just do whatever we want, make a song about whatever we want.
I was sitting at the stoplight. In my car, rolled down the window. When this driver pulled on side of me, she offered me some endo. I told her that I didn't smoke, but I thanked her for the offer. I thought I might just ask her name. Instead, I made a left.
And I think when felt falls short is when it does make an atmosphere song. Or it does make a Merce song. You know, there are songs that we've put on the records that we're like, ah, that's, you know, that's unfortunate. Like, we should, you know, it sounds like an atmosphere song featuring Merce all of a sudden. You know, it's too serious. It's trying to save the world. It was always my joke. It's like, oh, atmosphere songs are all trying to save the world. And I want to figure out how to make songs that just don't care. Fuck the world. You know, the last record I made, that was a really big motivator, was like, I feel like I hit a couple of songs where I was like, this song is not saving anybody's fucking life. This song can't save shit. It's just a thing with some words that rhyme, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like, man, I love it. You know, I want to explore more of that with atmosphere music because me and Anthony do have a side to us that I don't think we always show. And that's the side of just, we're corny. We're, you know, it's like a lot of times people will point at certain stuff that comes out of my mouth and go, yeah, I like Slug, but he keeps saying corny shit like that. And it's like, you got to realize I strive to say corny shit. Like, I'm trying to say cornier shit because I feel like I've spent a lot of time in the past just working too hard at saying things that are meaningful or something, you know, and I'm over it.
It's funny you talk about the whole being perceived as serious and therefore people don't see you as funny thing. I just actually talked to Dr. Dre, the Yo MTV Raps one, And, you know, he goes back with Chuck D to when he was in college. And he said, you know, when he had Chuck on Yo MTV Raps and they were joking around like they used to do back at WBAU, he got a lot of pushback. People were like, how can you insult Chuck D's mother or whatever? Like that, and that people just couldn't. They saw him as like the serious spokesperson of Black America and couldn't square that with, you know, him snapping on his friend.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny in rap and, you know, by and large in Black America, a lot of, we'll say the majority don't want to see, they don't want to see Black entertainers as being like multi-sided. They want a simplified picture. So Chuck D is serious, and that's who Chuck D is. And Tupac was angry, and that's who Tupac was. And so on and so forth. They don't want to know or realize that Tupac had some jokes too, and they don't want to know that Chuck had jokes. And then you know, with the Black comedians, they don't want a Black comedian to be depressed. Also, you know, they just want, and I mean, I think that's changing, you know, mm-hmm. but I do know that when I was younger, like that was a real thing. They didn't want to let Black men or Black women be, they didn't want duality. They didn't want multifaceted personalities. Mm-hmm. They just wanted something real simple. You know, that's kind of how they saw rap. You know, they like, you know, a big thing that I pushed back on when Atmosphere first started breaking through. And I was watching critics rip apart not just Atmosphere, but other of my contemporaries that were doing different types of rap that didn't sound like Dipset. And I'm like going, hold up, these white college educated journalists are trying to tell me that they relate more to Dipset. I need a couple birds, get abroad, have them sent up. Call my bird, get my broad, have her sent up. Than they do to Aesop Rock. When the clock strikes nine, I'll be waking with the best of the routine caffeine team players for the cycle of it. Under a dusted angel heart string, Big Brother is watching my odometer like Buzzard the folding out, talking stealth. You're full of shit. You know what I'm saying? But because Dipset does what you picture as the Black experience, what are you saying right now? You're basically saying that the Black experience is like selling drugs and wearing nice clothes, and that's all you're going to, but you won't listen to what Merce has to say. You're throwing Merce under the bus for giving you something. Oh, that doesn't sound like the Black experience to you. You know what I mean? And I had a problem with that because I feel like that we needed to, you know, kind of, and granted that was a different time. Now rap, it's really interesting to watch how, thankfully, Kanye, Lil Wayne, some of these pop stars, some of these rappers that became absolute pop stars were so weird that it broke a lot of barriers for everybody. And right. it allowed young Black males to have different types of personalities finally. You know what I mean? It's like, thank God, because now we have Chance the Rapper. And now we have, you know, we have guys that are like, you can't just box them into, oh, he's a thug, or he's a funny guy, or he's an athlete. It's like, you can be all of it, or you can be none of it, right. You know? And I do appreciate, you know, and I give a lot of that to Lil Wayne and Kanye West, because those two specifically, they became pop icons, like Madonna level pop icons, and they were weird, you know?
Yeah.
White dudes have been weird forever.
Right. There's been the space for them to be weird.
There's been
forever.
A space for them to express whatever, yeah. You know what I mean? Go wear a dress. You know, go right. Get on stage with whatever you want to do. You know, put a paper mache head on your shoulder and come on stage with two heads, Bowie, whatever you want. You know, they didn't allow that from Black dudes. You know, you look back at like Little Richard, who was like trying to express and be himself and do all that stuff, and it's like people were like, oh, he's, you know, he's tight, but I don't know, I can't really mess with him, you know what I mean? It was like it just wasn't acceptable yet.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of Little Richard reminds me, it wouldn't be right to speak to a Minneapolisan and not ask your thoughts about Prince on his passing.
Oh man, didn't see it coming, you know. I don't know if anybody who didn't personally know him could say they saw that coming.
Had you run into him over the years?
I have one Prince story. Ali has a really good Prince story too, that if you ever get the chance to talk to Brother Ali, I won't tell his story. I'll just tell mine.
Yeah.
But before I do, I want to say, like, just what I was saying about Kanye and Lil Wayne, Prince did that for a whole city. Like my whole city, even though we have created these dotted line boxes for us to stand inside of, ultimately, you know, I don't think I would even have tried to be who I am if Prince hadn't shown us to do it on your own terms. You know, Rhymesayers probably, we probably would have never even built a record label if we weren't from Minneapolis, because I think that there's an air in Minneapolis with art that is, it's self-supportive. We depend on ourselves. We look out for each other. And I think a lot of that, you know, whether it's obvious or not, I think a lot of that comes from Prince. I think Prince really opened up a lot of doors for us to just express ourselves and to create things without worrying about like who's going to allow it to happen. As far as him passing, that was, you know, that was heavy. Like I put that up there with my father passing and with Mikey passing. And I didn't know Prince like that, but it just really forced me to kind of, I guess, acknowledge and even deal with the fact that he had such a large impact on my youth, especially.
Yeah. What was your story with him?
In the 90s. I used to work at a record store called Electric Fetus, and it's like the hub in the city. It's a place where you like jazz, this is where you go to buy records. You like rap, this is where you go to buy records, you know. And I was one of the rap guys there, you know. So people come in and be like, "Hey, what should I buy?" And I could literally put out tapes and be like, "Buy those," and they'd buy them and walk out. It was almost like I was prescribing medicine for people, you know. Yeah. So everybody that works there is a musician. A guy named James Everest, working with a woman named Jen Downham, organized a weekly residency at a club for us all to have these jam sessions, you know, a couple of rappers, and I was the main rap guy. So I was kind of, you know, helping coordinate who would come down. And so I'd bring different friends down, and oftentimes, you know, Idea would be down there, or I Self Divine from the Micronauts would be there. Gene Poole. One night, it was basically the Dino Spectrum was down there. It was me, it was Iself, it was Gene Poole. And we're on stage and we're rapping, and there's a guy named John Keston on the keys, and I'm trying to remember. I don't remember who else was there. And there's a woman who was an on-air personality for the local news. Her name was Robin, and she was kind of a tastemaker in the city, because not only was she kind of famous because she was on the news every night, but she'd come to the parties. We'd see her, you know, I'd smoke weed with her. You know what I mean? Like, she was cool.
Yeah.
And we all knew she was friends with Prince. You know, she's friends with everybody. Well, one night, me and Iself were on the stage, and all of a sudden he taps me. He's like, "Hey, is that little man over there?" And I look, and it is. It's Prince. She brought Prince to this club that holds like 250 people. It's a small room. It's about the size of four of these hotel rooms, you know?
Yeah.
And so now the pressure's on. Like, Prince is sitting in the corner listening to us, you know? So close my eyes and just start freestyling and rapping and going and going and going. And all of a sudden I hear John over there on the keys. He's starting to bang away a little heavier. He's riding over me. And I'm like, "Oh, come on, don't do this right now." You know what I mean? It's not the time to solo. And I look to give him that look, and it's not John, it's Prince. He had climbed up there. And I didn't realize, because I was rapping with my eyes closed, trying to find, you know, words that rhyme. And so now I'm consciously going, do I fall back to let Prince do his thing, or do I just go in?
Right.
So, of course, I go in because of my ego. And he wins. He murders me. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's no way to go in over Prince soloing on a piano.
Right.
And then, so I finally, I fall back and I let him finish. And standing ovation, you know, the place used to get full just because it was hip. But tonight it was almost like these people were now floating. Everybody in the room was floating because Prince just showed up, right. You know. And he hops off the little stage and beelines out the front door and leaves. He was there for all of 6 or 7 minutes. You know what I mean? It was just the weirdest thing. He like showed up just to do that and dip. And so I was sitting there like, "What? I'm just glad I got that opportunity to rap." You know,
yeah,
I
remember be on stage with him, however briefly.
Yeah. I got home like 2:30 in the morning and woke my mom. I called my mom to tell her what just happened. You
wow.
know,
wow, amazing. So one final thing, we asked Murs this as well. So I've got to ask you: Ricci, Bonet, or Perez?
Oof. I mean, me personally, probably Bonet. You know. But honestly, whatever. All three of them. You know what I mean? Like, any of them, you know? A distant cousin of any of them. Whatever, man. Like,
will there be a Felt Four, by the way?
Oh, God, I hope not. You know, just the fact that I just said, oh, God, I hope not, means there probably will. You know, it's just like, the thing with Felt, people are always like, when are you going to do Felt? When are you going to do Felt? And it's like the same answer as the last time. We don't know. We don't plan Felt. It just happens whenever our schedules open up and we're like, hey, you want to hang out for a couple of weeks? Merce will come and spend 2 weeks at my house, or I'll go spend 2 weeks out there. And as it stands, now that I've started having more kids again, and now that Merce is a parent, you know, the odds of us having that free time is becoming less and less and less. And so I don't know if we'll ever see the universe line up our schedules again.
Yeah.
I don't know if there'll ever be another Felt, you know, but they're always a lot of fun to make. And I always learn new stuff. I learn new things about rapping, working with Merce. And I'd like to believe that he does as well. I think we teach each other things, you know? And we just have a good time. Like, we hang out. We like sports. We like, you know, food. You know what I mean? It's like we have a lot of things in common outside of rap. Sports and food.
Right. No one else likes that shit.
Nobody.
And I guess just, sorry, one last thing is, like, you've been on tour through the election, like, you know, before the election, election night, and now, you know, we are as we're recording this a week out. What on earth has that been like?
Well, leading up to the election, the anxiety that you could feel in the room at the show pre-election, it was there. It wasn't there 2 months ago, 3 months ago, but that last, like, 2 weeks before the election, you could start to feel it. I was getting more and more pushback on the fact that I was rocking Jill Stein shirts. Like, I was a Green Party supporter. Mm-hmm. You know, more and more people give me a hard time. Like, you know, she's going to steal votes from Clinton and all this, whatever, whatever. But there was room for dialogue. There was a lot of dialogue with fans, with other artists, you know, and it was all rooted in anxiety. Everybody was anxious. Post-election, the shows have been amazing. Twice as amazing as prior. And I feel like this election, as weird and as unfortunate as the results turned out to be, I do feel there's a odd thing that happened, a turning point, maybe even a galvanizing that is occurring right now amongst people who prior to this maybe didn't necessarily see themselves as part of a movement or of a, and the thing is, this movement is a majority movement. It's interesting. And so I'm kind of reluctantly optimistic right now about the direction that things are going to go. I guess, you know, sometimes you have to hit rock bottom in order to pick yourself up. And I guess that's the kind of optimism that I'm having right now. Now, it's only a week out, so we'll see where I'm at in January,
right,
in March, in next summer. You know, I do believe that it's important to listen to people who talk who have lived through dictatorships. You know, there are plenty of media sources out there. There are plenty of people out there who have things to say that we could learn from right now, because they've lived in countries and regions that have gone through these weird types of changes of the regime. And when people use words like dictatorship and fascism and whatnot, I realize those are trigger words, and a lot of times we don't even know if we're supposed to take it serious. But I do think we should. I do think that, you know, especially watching this guy start to pick names for his cabinet and his surroundings, I feel like I think right now would be a good time for us to learn from some other people's histories and listen to what some other people have to say who have actually lived through these types of things. Because technically we've got 2 months to get our shit together, you know, before all of these major media sources that we know are just fully under the thumb. You know, and it's crazy to think like that, because the truth is these media places have been under the thumb. You
right.
know, CNN, Fox, all these guys are full of shit, and they've all been under some form of control, whether you got like an actual guy calling them, telling them what to do, or if it's just a matter of following the dollar, whatever it is, like there's an agenda And that's obvious. That's been there. But now I feel like it's going to become, it's one of those things where I feel like I don't think it's going to be as hidden as people have tried to hide it. It's going to be in our face, and we get to just eat shit, you know? But like I say, my hope is when we've been performing these shows and I've watched these audiences, I don't even know who in the audience voted for who.
Sure.
You know, some of the people in this crowd voted for Trump.
They must. Yeah. I mean, just numerically. Right. Yeah.
And so, but to see even them go, I needed this. I needed this moment. I needed to have some fun. Like, I feel kind of like, wow, like there's just a collective exhale going on. And once we're done exhaling, you know, hopefully we could pick up some pieces and keep it moving. You know, I commit to trying to do whatever I can do to be helpful. You know, in the past, I've always tried to be a signal booster of things that I believe in, as far as Twitter goes. In my own city, I try to show up for the events and for the protests when I can, mm-hmm. you know, and I try to be a voice of reason and also a voice, you know, against the oppressions that go on, especially in my own city. But, you know, just universally, you know, I want to be there and I want to be open for dialogue with people. You know, I appreciate social media for that, you know, and I realize there's a lot of people that are like, oh, social media activism is bullshit and whatever, whatever. But it's like, well, it's sure. But 10 years ago, before it existed, activism was very different and it was a lot harder to get in touch with each other. And it was a lot harder to get some of this stuff done. So it's not just bullshit. You know what I mean? Yeah, I'm scared, but I ain't going nowhere, you know? I'm not one of those people that's like, wow, we're going to have to move to Sweden. So are you kidding? The alt-right in Sweden are just as fucking scary as they are here. Like, right. Shit, man. Like,
yeah, where are you going to go? Germany? Where France? Are you
gonna, Canada? Like,
yeah.
Like, the only place I'd consider going right now is Mexico. You know what I mean? Like, or somewhere in South America, you right. know? It's like that, to me, yeah. Because A, ain't nobody going to look for me there. You know what I mean? But B, I feel kind of like in times like this, places that are, I don't know how to word what I want to say here, but like I say, the underdog, mm-hmm. to me, the underdog is a very important position. You know, that's exactly what happened here. They posited Trump as the fucking underdog for so long and look what happened. You know what I mean? It's like, And so, yeah, if I was to pack up my shit and go somewhere, I probably would go to Mexico. But of course I can't, because then Zika will get me.
Right.
And then I can't get pregnant.
All right. Well, we'll have to do a part two in Mexico. Sean, thank you so much.
Yeah, man. Thank you.
As is obvious if you listen to this interview, I've been a fan of Atmospheres and of Slugs for a very long time. We've been trying for a while now to get him on the show, and I'm beyond thrilled that it finally happened. It was great to hear how Slug thinks about his work, and how he remembers the parts of his career that I only got to see from the crowd or from the stereo. I've long been curious about what someone who literally invented the term emo rap thinks of the glut of music that now fits that description. I was also blown away by how he described his relationship with the late Idea. Join us next week when our guest will be DJ J Period. Jay has created incredible musical documentary mixtapes for the likes of Lauryn Hill, Q-Tip, Nas, and more. He's responsible for the live mixtape performances with Black Thought. He's composed for TV and film, and even DJed for the Brooklyn Nets. And on December 2nd, he'll unleash his latest project along with The Roots and Lin-Manuel Miranda, the Hamilton Mixtape. We'll talk all that and much more. Don't throw away your shot to hear it next week on The Cypher. Like I said at the beginning, make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating and a review. Don't forget to visit patreon.com/thecyphershow if you enjoy the program, and help us out with as little as a dollar a month. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
I was drinking a lot, and I was smoking a lot, and I was not sleeping much.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Oh, wow. You're really good at spinning on your head.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
It's my enemy.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
What does that even mean?
Special thanks to Patreon supporter and my main man, Tobias Wilinski.
Which is always kind of the best position to be in.
And extra special thanks to Richie Abbott for making this happen.
Top five dead or alive. I put him in the top five.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
No, no, no housekeeping, please. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Just so you know, it's a little past four now. Do you need to?
Oh, you know, I don't even know because I've been on airplane mode, so I don't know if these dudes are trying to call me. So I'll tell you what, though. Where are you at?
I mean, as long as you have time for. You know what I mean?
Got you. Let's I'll tell you what. Let's go to 4:20.
Great.
All right, and then we'll smoke weed.
Give me the love. My name's Slug. Give me a pound or a hug.